This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're presenting a holiday series featuring recent interviews with great songwriters and singers. In April, I spoke with Ray Davies, the co-founder of The Kinks. He released his first solo record of new original songs last spring. Before we hear about it, here's a Kinks hit from 1965 that you may be able to identify in two notes. In the daytime. That record, All Day and All of the Night, along with You Really Got Me, Tired of Waiting for You, A Well-Respected Man, Lola, Sunny Afternoon, and Waterloo Sunset, made the Kinks one of the great and enduring British bands that came out of the 60s. But they haven't made an album of new songs since 1993. My guest Ray Davies wrote and sang most of the Kinks songs. His brother Dave was featured on guitar. The solo album of new songs Ray Davies released this year, called Other People's Lives, was described in Rolling Stone as a masterpiece. Before completing the record, Davies was shot in New Orleans while chasing a guy who stole his girlfriend's purse. But we'll get to that story a little later. Here's the opening track of Other People's Lives. It's called Things Change.
Things are gonna change. This is a morning. When reality bites, the morality kicks in to those damaged limitations. This is the morning after all that went before, all of the sun and laughter. Things are gonna change. This is the morning after.
That's Ray Davies from his new CD, Other People's Lives. Ray Davies, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, how are you?
Why is this your first ever solo record? Why has it taken this long?
I think being in the Kinks for so long was just I didn't realize until I wasn't with the band how life-consuming it was, how much of my life was wrapped up in it. And me as a person, you know, you have to remember that I started this when I was just college, you know. I was barely formed as a human being and as a character. And I grew up in that band. And I had my life experience, in many respects, is limited to being in the band. So when I came to record this record, I had to find out who I was as an individual, because all the Kinks music was part, it was part of a machine, part of a, I know I wrote the songs, so I had an element of freedom, but everything had to be targeted. It was a Kinks, as you say, product.
Now, the way I've read it, it sounds like you came to the United States as part of that process of writing new songs. You wanted to get away from the environment that you'd written in all along. So.
Yeah.
Was that the reason for moving to the States for a while?
Well, Things Are Going to Change was written while I was still living in Surrey in England. It's a nice, very rural, there. And I was saying to myself, things have got to change in my life. I've got to move on. You know, I don't know how a person can sit in one house all their lives and write lots of books, songs, and poetry. I needed to go on a journey. And that's what it felt like. It wasn't enough being not with the band. I needed to have an upheaval of some sort. You know, looking, it's easy to say it now, but I didn't know it then. So I came to America, 2001, toured here, just after 9/11, and I was writing songs and shooting my own video diary on the road.
So I know you spent a good deal of time in New Orleans. Did you move to New Orleans?
After the tour was over, I went back to New York, where I was based, and realized I needed to find, and this sounds very grand, but I wanted to find the source of the music that inspired me when I first started out. And the country that made me want to pick up the guitar was America. That, you know, it was American music. And all the people I was inspired by, from Hank Williams, country music, Big Bill Brunzi, who came from Chicago, but I think was actually born in Mississippi, all somehow had a connection with the South. And, you know, I liked Dixieland as a kid. You know, we had a lot of that music in the house. And I went to the Highgate Jazz Club where I grew up and saw Dixieland. So I wanted to go there and see it. And I went for some personal reasons. I went on a personal visit as well. But I grew attracted to the place.
Let's hear one of the songs that I think relates in some way to New Orleans. It's called The Getaway. And it starts with a line about, you know, lonesome train. And that's such an American blues kind of thing. Mm. I don't know. There's a lot of trains in England. I don't know that you'd associate them with, like, the lonesome train.
Absolutely. I'm very coy about using phrases and terms that have been used by other people. I love blues music, but I never attempt to be a blues man. Mm. And lonesome trains, yeah, the lonesome whistles and all that from the classic Hank Williams songs and the blues men, as you said. But I was there, and I actually, every morning I'd hear that train coming in, and it woke me every morning, and I loved hearing it. It was like a friend. And when it reminded me of where I grew up in North London. I lived very close to a train track. And it was a comfort zone for me to be there. But then, you know, this element of change in my life I was going through with relationships and personal life. The line just came into my head, and I didn't feel ashamed or feel coy about using every time I hear that lonesome train roll down the track. My only concern, it was a lot for me to say in one breath. That's all that worried me. It's just because you're there. You see, I'm not writing blues music, I'm not writing jazz, I'm in New Orleans, but I'm seeing the world in a slightly different way. I'm not ashamed to say things like that. And that's good enough. And that's worth the journey.
Well, let's hear The Getaway. And this is from Ray Davies' new album, which is called Other People's Lives.
Every time I hear that lonesome train roll down the track, going away to unknown destinations, just moving on, suddenly gone, and so unexpectedly. It might hit you on a sunny afternoon. Without a warning, there's a thought, it just comes over.
That's The Getaway from Ray Davies' new CD, which is called Other People's Lives, and it's his first solo CD. All of his other CDs have been as a member of the Kinks. I really like the song a lot, and to me it's a song about, you know, somebody who makes their getaway from a relationship or from a neighborhood or a home or maybe even from life itself. Mm. Somebody who's just, you know, made the final exit intentionally. Yeah. I don't know if you feel that way, but as a listener, it seems to me it's speaking on all those levels.
That's precisely the level I was, or the levels I was writing about. You know, the secret is, though, not to know it when you're writing it.
Uh-huh.
Just to feel and do all the analysis later on. I don't intellectualize what I write because I think my instinct is smarter than my actual being. And there's a long fade out in that song, and there's a reason for that. It goes on and on and on, and if you just think about it, it's like there's a punchline and a voice, a deep voice comes up at the end. like whispering in my ears, the singer's ear, saying, "Yeah, man, it's time to get out the door. It's time to make that move. You've been saying it all your life. Do it. You know, make the move or you're going to get the lonesome train." So the lonesome train is isolation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Was there something specific you were making your getaway from when you wrote that song?
I think there's an element of escape on the entire record. That's a theme that goes through it. Again, not knowing it. So I'm sitting down in my little studio in Surrey in England, 1998, thinking, I have to get away from this if I'm going to keep writing.
My guest is Ray Davies. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in April with songwriter and singer Ray Davies, the co-founder of The Kinks. This year, he released his first solo album of new original songs. This is a pretty horrible story. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, have already heard it. But while you were living in New Orleans...
Well, it was when I'd moved out to start... I came back to England to at the end of 2003 to finish the recording. All the songs on this album were written prior to 2004 and recorded. And I went over to New Orleans. We were going to have a holiday there, New Year's, spend New Year's. We had a good New Year's Eve there. And about the 4th of January 2004, I got attacked and shot. Yeah, it was quite harrowing.
Would you describe what happened?
Well, just walking around the street, walked around. I used to go jogging a lot at night on my bicycle. I love cycling in New Orleans. And this was a sunny afternoon, late in the afternoon. Guy came up with a gun, attacked us, and stole my girlfriend's bag. And I ran after him. I just had a bad day, I think. And this was just the topper. I didn't really want to deal with anything, but I just felt... you just never know until it happens to you, I suppose, how a person reacts.
Well, that's the thing. Did you decide to chase after this guy with a gun, or did you just reflexively do it without even thinking?
Well, the irony is that, you know, near the end of this record took a long time to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really losing my temper with myself and everybody around. I was irritable, not nice to be around because I hadn't finished my work. And that was left in England. But after that, we'd been to a restaurant and I just decided to be a calmer, better, easygoing person. And actually, I don't mind if I don't finish this record or I don't mix this record. I'm going to relax here, maybe buy a place here and live in New Orleans. And walk out and get shot. And in a sense, I was put into hospital and my injuries were quite more severe or serious than people realized. But it gave me the incentive to get back and come to terms with finishing my record and getting it done. That was my quest after that.
So when your girlfriend's purse got nabbed by this guy with a gun. Did you just reflexively run after him or did you make a conscious decision?
It's a question I'll always ask myself and I'm still trying to work that out.
You're not sure?
Not sure. I just didn't feel it was right to be treated that way. And what... this is so difficult to talk about, but... he was really scared, and he's the one that had the gun. I got a close look at him, and he was really scared. And I just felt it was not right to let him get away with it. And I didn't know there was a car waiting and a driver. And he stopped. I nearly caught him, and he stopped at the car and just turned around and shot me.
You, like everybody who watches TV or goes to the movies, has seen a lot of people shot over the years on screen. What surprised you most about what it's like to be shot in real life as opposed to what it looks like in the movies?
You know, I was kept in this hospital, this grand but sad, and now I think it's a derelict hospital called Charity Hospital. At the time, it was running at full, you know, its full powers for what that's worth. And they did the best there, but they had very limited resources.
It's a hospital for the poor.
It's a poor town, as everybody knows now. And
how did you end up in a hospital for the poor?
Because I was just a body brought in from in an ambulance. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't wave, say, "Hey, I'm Ray Davis, and I've been shot." It actually hurts. And they took me to the hospital, and I remember them having. I was in hospital. My leg was broken. They didn't know it, and so they tried to get me to walk in the hospital, and it finally snapped while I was in the hospital.
Oh, that must have hurt.
They were just relieved that I was alive. Uh-huh. And anyway, I was in the ward, and they had a telethon on. They had one television on in the ward all the time, and it was a James Bond telethon.
Oh no!
And people are getting shot all the time.
That's so funny.
And they just fall over, and that's it.
But they quip. They always quip when they're shot in James Bond movies.
You've had your shot. There's always a James Bond quip. Yeah, and I just watched it with the sound turned down. You know, I didn't really pay much attention. It hurts, and I feel, you know, you just feel how every day, you know, we see on television in horrible wars now that are televised live almost. Yeah, you know, the suffering that goes on, it just made me appreciate that a little more, how terrible these bombings are and explosions and war in general.
If you don't mind my asking, was there a moment where you saw the shooter looking at you and taking aim, and you knew was there a moment you knew you were going to get shot?
Yeah, it was a classic, you know, how they train people to shoot guns, you know, that position, that crouch position.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just ran, dived, like they do in the movies. And, I try not to think about it, because there are only fragments, you know. It's like writing songs. It's a line, one-liners. It's not a constant memory, a constant replay.
So, I mean, like, even when you think about it, you only have fragments of that memory. Mm. There isn't one complete connected narrative that you have.
Yeah, it's just like songwriting.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Would you ever write a song about this?
I already had at that time. The song was called "I, the Victim," and that's the most harrowing part of this whole process. It was the recovery process that was the most difficult, because I had to go back to my music. And there's a song on the album called "After the Fall." There's a song on the album about tourists, take the money, you know, attack the tourists, whatever. And I'd written the song "I, the Victim," which was almost the incident played out. And I don't know if I'll go back to that. It may come out on another record, but it's... I didn't write a song called "You Really Shot Me." I don't recommend it for any aspiring songwriters if they're looking for source material.
Your life seems like it's been very eventful lately, but you were shot. Your brother had a stroke. How severe was it? Like, does he have his memory and his ability to talk and sing and walk?
He has all those, thankfully, but it's getting back to normality for him is difficult. And he never does things slowly. He's like me. We've lived quite pressured lives, you know, a lot of pressure, traveling, doing things. And he's playing again.
He can play guitar again.
He stayed with me for a few months. When he was recovering. This happened over a year ago.
That's interesting that you stayed together for a few months, because, you know, everything I read about your relationship is that it's this really rocky relationship. You only see each other when you perform.
Yep.
And, you know, that's part of the reason why the Kinks aren't really together.
Mm.
And I guess after the stroke, you got close?
I've never been not close to him. It's just that we have a... All siblings are the same. I think they fall out, some more than others, and happens that we fall out a lot. But, you know, he wasn't helpless. He's recovered really well. I'd see him in hospital, and I was just trying to do the right thing. Both our parents are dead, and I think it was the right thing to do, try and look after him. And look after him, you know. He had his girlfriend with him, and they stayed in another part of the house. And but we'd eat dinner together, and that was really good. Watch movies, And as he started to recover, he got more aggressive towards me, and now he's back to normality.
Still into those big power chord kind of thing?
He's still, you know, my brother's got incredible hands. He's got very strong hands. And I was auditioning all these guitar players, and with no disrespect to any of them, there were so many great players, but nobody could hit power chords like Dave. It's just like it's just something he put his body through, you know. It's just like it's like one of those karate people. You know, they've got those very strong hands.
Ray Davies, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Ray Davies recorded in April. The solo album he released this year is called Other People's Lives. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.